The American History Podcast, Episode 13, Puritan Relations with the American Indians.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
This is episode 13, and we're just about ready to wrap up the first season here at the American History Podcast. Again, I just want to thank you for listening to the show. I truly, truly, I am shocked that more than just my wife and my mom and dad are listening to the show. Actually, the funny thing is, the wife doesn't listen, partly because she hears me pontificate on history all the time, and she edits my papers for grad school, so she gets quite enough. But you are definitely appreciated, and I hope to continue the show for as long as you'll have me. So as always, please go to iTunes and give us a good review or just rate the show. Those good reviews and ratings help to attract new listeners, and they help those who are interested in American history find us. If you have any comments or questions or concerns, please you can email me through the website, www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com. You can also find me on Twitter, at AmericanHisCast. So those are all the ways to find me. Okay, before we delve into the relations between the Puritans and the American Indians, I just want to mention a few important points. Remember, New England was made up of more than just the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Don't forget you have Connecticut, New Haven, and Rhode Island. And so when I refer to the MBC or to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, you can assume that I'm also including Plymouth in there, unless I directly mention Plymouth. If I'm saying New England, I'm probably referring to all of the above. Okay. Now, the second thing is that what you're going to learn today is probably going to be a bit shocking and controversial. The conventional wisdom amongst the layperson here in the United States, and even amongst some historians who perhaps do not study the Puritans, is that they were evil, two-faced jerks whose only desire was to exterminate the heathen. Now, as historian Tom Woods points out, part of the reason for this is the fact that textbook writers have essentially ignored a lot of recent research, which gives us not only a better understanding of the subject, but casts the Puritans in a better light. In essence, what you're talking about is a split in the historiographical record. On the one hand, you have those who don't specialize in Puritans, continuing to perpetuate the one-dimensional, hostile portrayal of the Puritans. And on the other hand, you have these specialists who focus on the Puritans, people who write for the professional journals, and they've been more sympathetic to the Puritans in recent decades. An example of that is Alden Vaughn's work, New England Frontier, Puritans and Indians, 1620 to 1675. In this work, Vaughn argues that the Puritans were not as hostile toward their native neighbors as they are portrayed in the conventional accounts. Now, a second work, which was also suggested by Woods, is Francis Jennings' The Invasion of America. And this one puts the work, puts the Puritans, I should say, in the most negative light possible. Okay, the problem with Jennings is that the author admits to not having evidence for some of his claims and then goes on to blame the Puritans for having destroyed the evidence. But he doesn't have any evidence the Puritans destroyed the evidence either. So while that might be true, we can't make judgments based on evidence that does not exist. You have to go with what you've got. So what I'm going to go with is the Vaughn argument, mainly because I think you probably get heard the Jennings side so often that this argument is actually going to be kind of a corrective and help to balance out the narrative. All right, so just a quick word of background. 1616 and 1617, if you remember, epidemic disease decimates the population in the New England area. And thanks to that epidemic, which I mentioned in episode 11, that area had a population of less than 20,000 natives. So the epidemic totally devastated the indigenous population. There were about 0.22 people per square mile. So it's like not very few people left. All of these people were Algonquins, and they could communicate with each other at the basic level, but there were language barriers that existed between each one of these groups. Okay. Now, the Puritans, in their commentaries on the Indians, don't harshly condemn the natives, believe it or not, but they don't exactly lavish them with praise either. In their words, it's a mixed picture. They do freely acknowledge the generosity and the kindness of the native peoples, no doubt. I mean, that's right there. It's in the record. But they're also critical of the native peoples, and their criticism is that they're lazy drunkards. Now, this one is much more controversial, obviously. Especially, let's take those two words, lazy and drunkard, and let's look at the first one, lazy. The women, just as an example, were very hardworking. Okay, they did backbreaking work in and around the household, raising the children, keeping the house together. Just stuff that I sure as heck wouldn't do. So at least half the population is not lazy. Now, when you look at the male side, during hunting season, men also had to work very hard. Hunting is no fun, no joke. And if you're not successful, you don't eat. So that accusation is spurious at best. Now we get to the difficult part, and that's the accusation of drunkenness. Indians, in their own testimony, accuse themselves of being drunkards. Now, remember, they did not have the equivalent of strong drink, and the Puritans did not believe that it was wise to simply distribute alcohol to the Indians, since the natives had never experienced alcohol before. So there's those two things. And another point is that the natives, they lived at basically a subsistence level that was equal to that of the Stone Age. And now, look, this is not a criticism. So I don't want to get a ton of emails saying, you know, I'm being a jerk. I'm just stating a fact. They weren't walking around with iPhones. And because of this, the Puritans actually felt it was wise to do two things: keep both weapons and alcohol out of the hands of the Indians. In the case of keeping weapons out of their hands, it was a command of the king that they were upholding. Keeping alcohol out of their hands, they thought, was a wise idea, again, because they did not have experience with alcohol, and they didn't want them to degenerate into alcoholism. Now, contrary to common perceptions, the Puritans did try to keep their own people from mistreating the natives. Of course, you probably take this statement with a great deal of skepticism, and that's understandable. It goes against everything that we've been taught in school, and so you're probably thinking that I'm either insane or I'm just making this up. And I get it. I understand your skepticism. But the documentary evidence is pretty substantial. So just one example is Thomas Morton, who in 1629 came to New England and wanted to take an Indian canoe. He fired a round of hail shot, he took the canoe, and he ran away. Also in this encounter, he injured an Indian, besides stealing their property. So what happens to old Thomas Morton? Well, he's arrested, and the authorities ordered him to make restitution. What ends up happening is that they sold his goods and used the money they gained from that to ship him back to England and to pay the Indians for their canoe. His house was then burned down to the ground. So he couldn't, if he happened to come back, he wouldn't have a house there. Furthermore, in 1633 through 34, there's a terrible epidemic, and the Puritans do aid the natives, and they even take in orphans whose parents had died because of this illness. Okay, so the idea that the Puritans hated all Indians and just wanted to wipe them out, it's not quite as black and white as that, to say the least. Now, there is another area in which the so-called conventional wisdom differs from the historical record, and that is the idea that Europeans, in this case the Puritans, stole the land from the natives, or they tricked them into giving up the land. It doesn't hold up in light of the evidence, and as far as I can tell, specialists in the field would probably laugh at you for promulgating this idea. Yes, there certainly were instances where Europeans did treat natives unjustly, but you can't make a blanket accusation that it happened in all times and all places. That's just ahistorical, and it's just plain wrong, and it's unfair to the Puritans. And so what I'm saying is that, as far as I've read, it is correct to say that the Puritans gained land through voluntary secession on both sides, and both sides understood the terms of the agreement. There were cases when the Indians were treated horribly, no doubt about that, and we're going to talk about that in a moment. But at least on this issue of property exchange, the conventional wisdom is just plain wrong. And look, I understand it. Again, why people believe this stuff. We have this negative view of the Puritans as hypocrites. And it is true that the Indians started off with all the land, and then they ended up with pretty much nothing. So it's easy to think that the Indians were tricked. They were duped. They were just given worthless junk in exchange for great land. But remember, the Indians aren't stupid, okay? They're not. It's not like your modern human is smarter than Indians were, let's say, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, okay? They weren't going to just give up something if they didn't gain something in return, something that they valued more than the land that they were trading. The idea that they didn't understand private property and they only believed in communal land when talking about the Indians the Puritans were dealing with, that's also completely false. Anthropologists have not found any Indians in colonial New England who did not understand the concept of private property, and nor have we found any who held land in common. So further, you've got the deeds that are quite detailed and appear to be on the up and up. So that brings me to the question, how did the Indians perish? Well, about 15% died in wars between the Indians themselves or with the Puritans. The rest of them died in wave after wave of epidemic illness. Ironically, the more the Puritans now tried to help the natives, actually, the worse things got. Remember, the Europeans are exposing the Indians to germs and disease. So Indians who went to schools set up by Europeans, such as Harvard, ended up decimated. You should also understand that materially speaking, the Indians were quite poor. They were, however, rich in land. They had more land than they could ever want or use. They traded what they had for what they didn't have, but wished they did. So let me ask you this. Who are we to stand in moral judgment of the Indians for trying to improve their livelihood? Who are we to condemn them for trying to make life better in any way they possibly could? Maybe they preferred having that metal knife or a hoe and trading land for these things. Finally, the Indians in the Connecticut Valley region, they approached the Puritans wanting to trade. And so what I'm trying to say is that things are far more complex and far more colorful than the conventional narrative. It's not black and white and cartoonish like maybe your eighth grade teacher made it out to be or Hollywood films made it out to be. But in doing so, in doing this trading, the Indians were setting themselves up to then be decimated by epidemic disease. So, having said that, now let's look at a dark side of Puritan relations with the Indians. And the first event I'd like to talk about is the Pequot War. This takes place from 1636 to 1637. This war pitted the Pequots against the Puritans in the MBC, Plymouth and Saybrook colonies. Now, I should note that the Puritans had native allies, specifically the Narragansett and the Mohegan tribes. So it's not just the Europeans against the Indians. It's more complicated than that. Relations between the Puritans and the Pequots were strained in the years preceding the war in the Connecticut River Valley. The Pequots, they were expanding their area of control to the detriment of the Wampanoags, the Narragansetts, and the Algonquins, as well as the Mohegans, and even the Lenape. So there's a series of groups that are not happy with this. And the war has its origins now in a series of disputes over the fur trade and who was going to control it. In addition to the tensions, there's an Englishman named John Stone, a privateer, and his crewmen are murdered in 1634 by the Nianticks, That's a group of natives who paid tribute to the Pequots, so kind of an ally. Now, this war is fairly short. It's only about a year and a half, 2 years, but the effects are calamitous, at least on the Pequot. By the end of the war, most of the Pequot tribe was devastated, and the war ended with an agreement known as the First Treaty of Hartford. That agreement called for the Pequots to submit themselves to the authority of the Mohegans and the Narragansetts. Some were then enslaved and shipped to the West Indies, while some were forced to become household slaves in Connecticut and Massachusetts. And then finally, the Pequots are declared extinct, and the Pequots could no longer use the name Pequot. Okay, before we move on, I should note, Vaughn argues the war was not solely the fault of the Pequots. He says the escalation in violence comes about because of the actions of the Puritans, and until they escalated the violence, negotiation was actually a possibility. Now, in the aftermath of the Pequot War, the New England colonies realized collective security was needed for future defense against the Dutch, the French, and especially the American Indians. Thus, the New England Confederation was founded in 1643. Now, this was a short-lived military alliance made up of the MBC, Plymouth, Connecticut, and New Haven. The significance of this was that it's the first milestone on the road to colonial unity. It was an exclusively Puritan alliance, and it helped to solve intercolonial problems such as runaway slaves and criminals. The colonists drew up a set of Articles of Confederation, so to speak, and declared the purpose of their union to be, quote, a firm and perpetual league of friendship for offense and defense, end quote. Each colony would elect two commissioners to meet once a year and on special occasions, and these men had the power to declare war, to make peace, allocate military expenses amongst the colonies based on their population. They could also make recommendations to specific colonies, settle boundary disputes that might arise, and provide for the capture of fugitives, for example, runaway slaves. There was no executive, and finally, all of the commissioners had to be members of the Puritan Church. Now, the next major war was King Philip's War. Now, this was fought between the New England Confederation and the Indian chief Metacom, sometimes referred to as King Philip. Metacom was the Wampanoag chief and the son of Massasoit. Hope I didn't butcher that too much. The war lasts for about 3 years, and about 52 of the 90 existing Puritan towns were attacked and 13 destroyed. Now, this was a particularly brutal war for the time, and the American Indians copied the same Puritan tactics of attacking non-combatants that they had seen in the Pequot War. Now, in the end, the colonists were the victors, and once again, many Indians were sold into slavery and shipped out of the colony. This is a virtual death sentence, as Native Americans were not able to adapt to life in slavery, and they often died, either because they were worked to death or due to disease. Others, as if that wasn't cruel enough, others were simply set ashore on deserted islands or coasts and abandoned to their fate. Now, while it might appear that everyone in New England approved of such harsh treatment, this was not the case. One of the heroes of the war, Captain Benjamin Church, amongst others, objected to this barbarous treatment of the vanquished foes. Unfortunately, objections did nothing, and harsh treatment was the order of the day. Furthermore, Metacom himself was executed and his head displayed for 20 years. Finally, other effects of the war include, first, a massive death toll, which was approximately 1,000 colonists and 3,000 Indians, making it the bloodiest war ever fought on New England soil. Further, 20 towns in New England were destroyed totally, and half were severely damaged. The economic expense was also intense, as the war debt for Plymouth alone has been estimated to be greater than the total valuation of personal property of the colony at the time. Second, Native Americans were effectively removed from the MBC, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Having said that, conflict continued in northern New England for decades. The five tribes in the region of Acadia created an alliance with New France, and over the next 74 years, there would be six wars between New France and New England, with the respective Indian allies thrown in for good measure. Third, the success of the NEC was, according to historian Jill Lepore, the start of a separate American identity, separate from that of Great Britain. And finally, the success of New England caught the attention of the British Crown, seeking to cash in on the success of the colonies in the region. To conclude this episode, one can see a couple of characteristics of American warfare starting to form. First, Americans by 1700, in New England at least, we start to see amongst them the germination of what would become the American way of war. Attacks on non-combatants were seen as okay, and to some extent this telegraphs the development of the idea of total war. This sort of warfare might have been exclusive to use against native peoples in the 17th century, but by the 19th century, the forces of the Union would engage in total war against the Confederacy. Further, slowly but surely, the Americans are not only developing a separate identity from the British, but they're also developing an identity that is seen as the opposite of native peoples. Again, historian Jill Lepore notes in her book, The Name of War, that by the 17th century or the late 17th century, there was a fear amongst colonists in New England of being contaminated by natives. You might have heard the term, someone's gone native, gone native. That's what they were talking about. And this theme continues throughout the next two centuries or so. Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember, give us a review or a rating if you are in a hurry on iTunes so that others can find us and hopefully benefit from the show just as much as you have. If you have any questions, feel free to email me at sean@theamericanhistorypodcast.com. You can also find me on Twitter at AmericanHisCast. You can visit our website, sign up for email updates, check out the sources. Until next time, have a great day.